This is Dr. Holly Lucille's Mindful Medicine. Here's Dr. Holly Lucille.
Hi, folks. Thanks so much for being here. I am so happy about the discussion we're going to have on this particular episode. We're going to be talking about a better path to the end of life, and I have a very exciting guest with me. But first, I want to tell you it's a subject that's actually very near and dear to my heart because my mom passed away at the young age of 75 a couple years ago, and I have to tell you that her end of life is what still haunts me to this day. And that's why I can't wait to get into this subject. I have, it's interesting, we're going to talk about it, an ICU and palliative care specialist. She's going to ask how we can find a better way to die, and I think her answers in the discussion today is actually going to change lives. Dr. Jessica Zitter, she's an MD, MPH, that's a master's in public health, is an expert on medical experience of death and dying. Dr. Zitter, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I want to start out in asking you to define something for our listeners, because it's interesting. I think it is a rare combination, but you are double boarded in two specialties, one of pulmonary and critical care, and then also palliative care medicine. Can you explain what palliative care medicine is?
Absolutely. The word palliate comes from the Latin palliare, which means to cloak. And what you can imagine, sort of the image of a kindly person or doctor or some nurse taking a cloak and shielding it around a suffering patient. And it's really about soothing suffering, whatever the type of suffering it might be, whether it's physical or emotional or spiritual, and really helping to take care of somebody in that way. Something that we're not really trained to do in medicine and the rest of medicine.
No, yeah, I guess not. And so it's fascinating that you're boarded in that. Then also you've got the other side of critical care, which I think when I just say it, the image that pops into my head is a lot of gadgets and tubes and high level intervention when it comes to saving lives.
That's right. That's right. And that's originally what my image of medicine was. I thought that, being a caring doctor meant just, going in there, rushing in like a fireman and trying to save life, any life whatsoever from the fire, and use whatever tools and technology you need to use. And I love tools and technology. It just felt so heroic and wonderful. But what happened was that as I started practicing this type of medicine, I started to notice that, first of all, we used it on everybody indiscriminately. We just, by default, would sort of start to put, mounting amounts of technology and machinery in to help with failing organs. And I started
right.
to realize that there were real types of patients, groups of patients who were actually suffering from this, that I knew ultimately, and this was sort of subconscious at the time, that they weren't going to really benefit. There was no real chance that this person was going to recover. And yet I was so programmed to do this. I was so programmed to keep escalating care, that I didn't
sure.
necessarily understand that there was another way to do it. It just felt like that's what success was.
Yeah, so, okay, I have your I think this is a brand new book. It's called Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life, right in front of me. It's absolutely fascinating. And so you say that, as you said, you're sort of programmed. And I totally understand this, because I believe as Western allopathic reductionistic medical training, you have your scope, and it is at times, I think, very reductionistic. So you do what you're taught to do. And you had an experience when you were involved in your first code. And for the listeners, a code is when somebody really just flatlines and you want to save their lives. Can you talk about that and sort of how that led you to your journey and where you're at now?
Yes. That first code experience was one of many subsequent experiences that I went on to have that really started to build up this subconscious concern that maybe this approach, this paradigm I had been trained in, wasn't actually the right one, but I didn't really have words for it yet. And what happened at that time was I was an intern. I'd been waiting to have a code. I was so excited for my first code. I had been practicing for it. And, to me, that was sort of the symbol of life-saving and the symbol of caring for your patients. And and the symbol of technological, you know, miraculous technology. And so when it happened, I ran towards the room, and I was so excited and waiting to see who we were going to save. And when I got there, and I saw this patient who had clearly been deteriorating for probably years with very, very serious chronic illness. This patient had, you know, no fat, no muscle on his body. Everything had stopped working, his organs, everything. And I looked at this patient, and I saw one of my co-residents doing chest compressions, and I think that, you know, that ribs were broken, and I just thought, what are we doing? Again, right. It was subconscious because I didn't really know what else we would do. That was what I had been taught to do, but it was so brutal, and I sort of, you know, I was shaken by it. But then I just sort of said to myself, this is part of the deal. This is sort of part of what it means to be a doctor who cares for patients. And I went on, and it wasn't until 10 years later, and I met the palliative care movement, that I started to understand there was another way.
Oh, and I can't wait to talk about that other way, because I have to tell you, you know, lucky enough, I was my mom's medical power of attorney. And when I knew enough was enough, I stopped everything as soon as I could. And I just, you know, wanted to create, first of all, a very comfortable place for her. Gate fears. It was, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. I don't have a specialty like you, but I knew that she was in such poor health, and she had such severe metabolic acidosis. And I mean, I had a talk with the team, and literally I was scribing in just 2 pages full of what she'd been through in the last decade. And I was just like, you know what? No, enough, nothing else, no more. And we tried our best, but it was definitely devastating. And so I love this book, and I want everybody to get it. It's called Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life. Because as you said, in medical school, no one teaches you how to let a patient die. And as you're explaining, you know, you're excited to save them, but at what cost? So I want to talk to, explain how what patients fear more than death itself is the prospect of dying alone. Tell me more about that you've sort of figured out.
Well, you know, I would say it's dying alone as much as it is dying badly. And how do you define dying badly? Well, dying badly is dying in a way that an individual person wouldn't want to die if they knew and if they could have prepared. So again, badly is different for each person. Every single person has their own set of preferences and values and things that are important. But I think, you know, the vast majority of people would probably say, not everybody, because believe me, I've met many different people with many different preferences, but most people would say, if I'm not going to be able to be cognitively or emotionally myself again, you know, or I'm going to, you know, really be so weak that I'm never going to be able to live off of a breathing machine, for example, most people would say, I don't think I want to live that way. And that's, we know there was a big study that was done. It showed that more than half of people felt that being attached permanently to a breathing machine was a fate worse than death. So, you know, we know that there's a good number of people who feel that way. And if that's the case, the approach that we take now, and I can tell you as an ICU doctor, is we hook everybody up to machines by default unless they have actively opted out. And I think people need to understand that. That's my mission with this book.
Yes, great. Okay, and for my listeners too. So how do you help people? Like for me as a naturopathic doctor, one of my big principles that I consistently follow is prevention is the cure, right? So how do you help people prevent this very, you know, sort of tragic end of life? How do you help them formulate plans so that they don't have to experience pain or anxiety? Can they prepare?
Absolutely. And I would say it's education and communication is the cure here. You are willing to bring the topic of death and dying into your life and to confront that reality that we all know cognitively is a part of all of our lives and will ultimately be something that greets us all, if you're willing to bring that into conversation, to toss it around with your family members and really think about things. When things come up in the news, the Terry Schiavo case, the Jahi Macnath, if you're willing to bring that topic of conversation into your family and with your friends and to talk to your doctor about it and to talk about the what-ifs that could happen to you, well, in this case, I would want to live this way, and in that case, I would want to live that way. And by the way, my book gives a lot of suggestions for how to start planning and thinking about these things and talking about these things. If you're willing to do that, then you're much more likely, ultimately, to get what you want and not just to be treated like, you know, a widget on a conveyor belt. And if you don't engage in those conversations and you don't engage in that thinking, then we will treat you like we treat everybody by default for whom we don't know preferences, and that is to, you know, attach you to machines to support your body and to try to keep you alive as long as possible, which, as I said before, we know that many people don't want.
Yeah, because you say in our current medical culture, the old and the ill are put on what you call the end-of-life conveyor belt, so they are intubated, catheterized, and even shelved away in care facilities to live out their final days alone, confused, and often in pain. And this is such an important discussion, and it's such an important book for every single person to get, because you think, you know, you ask, you know, are people willing to bring death into life? But I have to tell you, it was interesting when my mom was passing, are people willing to bring death into dying? And that conversation of death into dying, because I felt lucky, because the decision that I ultimately had to make to let my mom just be comfortable and hopefully assuage any fears and comfort care was definitely where we were at. The nurses that I talked to were happy because my entire family was on that same page. We were willing to let her go and let her go in as much peace as possible. However, it was still traumatic. But the nurses told me that, you know, not every situation is like this, that there are people that their loved ones that want to hold on, that want to have that person live at no matter what expense. How do you deal with that?
Well, it's really, really tough. I mean, there are situations where you worry, and I write about this in my book, where you worry that the family dynamics or the personal dynamics of the surrogate decision maker are not necessarily geared towards the patient's needs, that there's some other dynamic playing out in that decision making where the patient isn't able to speak for herself. Other people are speaking for her, and yet you're concerned as the doctor or the nurse that maybe there's some other things going on here that aren't necessarily focused on the patient's needs. And that's just incredibly difficult. I mean, in situations like that, you know, it's really always, in every situation, it's always about continuing the conversation, trying to really focus the attention and the conversation and the decision-making on the patient. What would the patient say if she could sit here with us right now? What would she be telling us to do? And a lot of times, family members, even if they're initially consumed by emotion and guilt or whatever, they will eventually be able to start thinking more about the patient and what the patient would want to do. But sometimes you worry that they're not. And even if they insist and say, no, this is what she would want, you think, I'm worried that there's other stuff playing out here. And sometimes we send cases like this to the ethics committee. But, you know, again, that's only a limited, the ethics committee can't necessarily, quote-unquote, make it right. They'll usually advocate for just having more conversation with the family members, but we do end up relying on family members, and so we hope that everyone's making the decision that is the best for that patient, and sometimes we just can't know for sure, and it's hard. It's very stressful to worry about that.
You know, and then to your earlier point, I guess one of the things that we can all do to help mitigate that situation from happening is be self-advocates and be prepared and have this clearly in writing and follow some of the suggestions in your book. And once again, folks, it's Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life. You know, because I've always said, and I don't know if this is true at the end of life or into the next life, but when people are having difficult times in relationships or breakups, and I've been a big advocate of, hey, once, you know, if you can have a good goodbye, you know, I think that increases your chance of having a good hello. And I think if we can really treasure the end of our lives and, you know, what's to come, because who knows, that it's such a more positive experience than exactly what you've been experiencing when you've been sort of in that place where, as you said, there's that end-of-life conveyor belt that people are automatically put into.
Right.
And how do you help get this conversation going between patients and caregivers, or building those bridges between patients and caregivers?
Well, it's really, hopefully people will, there's many, many steps that I list and many resources in the appendix of my book for helping people to actualize that and begin that conversation in their own families. As a doctor, you know, if I'm in the intensive care unit and I have a patient who's really sick and I've got family members around and we're trying to have that conversation, then I have to use my own communication skills to get people to start talking about it. And there's a whole set of skills for how to, get people talking about this incredibly difficult conversation. I mean, people want to avoid difficult conversations, including doctors. And so it's not only hard for the patient, it's hard for me. And so it's a skill that we have to practice like any other skill, like surgery, like putting in a catheter. We have to practice it and practice it and practice it and continue to study it and continue to, you know, to really just use it even when it's uncomfortable. And there's other tools that we doctors can use to try to get ourselves through this difficult conversation, get ourselves into these conversations. But then, you know, we have to also be able to stand strong in the face of emotion, because especially, again, when we've delayed these kinds of conversations until the intensive care unit, when someone's really sick and dying, there's a lot of emotion that can come up in families who are unprepared for someone dying. And we doctors need to be able to stand there and not run away and not say, oh, okay, they told us just to do everything, let's just do everything. We need to realize that there's emotional responses, and sometimes the initial response we get or the anger we get is not going to be the final response or the final decision, and we need to be able to be strong enough, and let me tell you, it's really hard, to just stay with those patients and the families and help them process through this until they come to, hopefully, the decision that's closest to what is going to be best for the patient, and that takes time because it's a process.
Well, I love what you're saying, and I got to tell you, if I'm on my death's bed, I want you there advocating for me and being able to tolerate my family's craziness. But I got to tell you, I don't know. I mean, it takes time, as you said, it takes practice. So you mentioned before the palliative care movement. I want to know more about that, because is there training? You know, one of the things that I experienced, and you know, I was an ICU nurse before I went to naturopathic medical school, and you know, there.
Oh.
Yeah, and I also have been in the hospital a couple times. I hate to say, but you know, you get to a place where I see people working. They're understaffed. They're working long hours, and they're kind of on automatic pilot. That part of them, their compassion and that personalization of them, of their job, shuts down. And it's palpable sometimes when you're kind of vulnerable and in, you know, need of care and in compassion. So is there training that happens or is available to snuff this part of medicine up a little bit?
Yes. I'm so glad you asked. And again, I mentioned several of them in my resources. I think there's a program that I really love called Vital Talk. It's geared towards, you could go to it, it's geared towards people who are healthcare providers of, you know, they're nurses, and there's a whole variety of people who go to it. And I went to it, and I thought it was fantastic. And it's seminars, and now we're starting to teach their skills in our residency program, for example. But to become a trainer for this type of seminar, which I have become, you have to go to their very big seminars they were in Aspen, so it was very fun. And you do drill,
yes,
after drill after drill of communication and really practicing getting the words out and practicing standing still in the face of emotion. And they teach you how to do this in a way that's almost as, you know, there's almost as, it's the way somebody would teach you how to put in a catheter or do a surgery. It's just repetition,
right,
and practice, repetition and practice. And I found it very helpful.
That is great to know, and because I think this conversation, like I said, is so important, and that we do need to find a better path to the end of life when it comes to conventional Western reductionistic medicine, and protect ourselves. So I have a question for you. I noticed, so your website is your name, jessicazitter.com, and also facebook.com/JessicaZitter. I've noticed that you've dropped your credentials. No doctor, no MD, no anything. Tell me a little bit about that.
You mean just on the social media?
Yeah.
I will say that for those social media handles, it was just, I think it was just the the easiest way to do it. I have someone else managing my social media. So, you know, but I will say, I'm glad you asked it. No one's ever asked me that before. I really believe that one of the solutions to this problem, and you'll like this because as an ICU, as a former ICU nurse, I think you'll resonate with this. We have this profoundly hierarchical structure that we ascribe to in medicine, and particularly in the intensive care unit. And I don't think it works. I really think that if we're going to be successful, we need to have a much more collaborative approach to managing patients who are seriously ill. We've, you know, for a whole variety of reasons, now, one of which is, you know, there are so many people who are being left out of the decision-making who are really valuable and critically important to making the right decision. First and foremost, the patient and family, okay? We've got to be talking to patients and families much more than we are doing right now to learn and to know what's the best thing to do. Second of all, the nurses, the social workers, the chaplains, the nutritionists, they are critically important, particularly, by the way, the ICU nurses. They're at the bedside of these patients on usually one-to-one, meaning one patient, one nurse. So they spend the day with them and with
That's
their
right.
family. They know so much more than the doctor does about really important things like how is the pay, how, you know, what is their acceptance level about this illness? What are they thinking is going to be happening? Who is the important person to be speaking to? Who knows this patient the most? Who is this patient's best surrogate? You know, these are all important parts of the that are currently being left out of the entire process. And so I really believe that our hierarchical approach to care is really sabotaging us all.
Oh, gosh. Okay, I think I have fallen in love with you just a slight bit. So seriously, I agree with you so much. You know, I've been thinking about in my field, just dropping doctor altogether, seriously, because I'm just Holly Lucille, and because I have a lot of passion, I really care about people. I care very, very little about being a doctor or being noted as a doctor. I mean, in some cases, I mean, if anybody wants to call me a doctor, and then if they do, I'm going to charge them $5 towards my student loans. I think that's how I'll manage it. But I agree with you. I think we just need to open up these conversations. And that's what I try to do. This show's called Mindful Medicine, because I want to help people think things through, because it seems like there's so much, you know, there's just so much messaging out there. And I think if we help people wake up and use their minds, certainly about the end of life and certainly about what they can do to have the end of life be of quality and of peace, it's awesome. So I think we are running out of time, but Jessica Zitter, it is my pleasure to talk to you. I thank you so much for being here. Once again, folks, this is one of the most incredible books that I've read, Extreme Measures, Finding a Better Path to the End of Life. And where can people find it?
Well, please come to my website, jessicazitter.com. It's got a book page on it, and you can certainly find it there. You can find the audiobook, which I personally have recorded, and I'd love for you to listen to me say it, because it makes me feel closer to people knowing that they're listening to it out there. And there's a whole lot more information on my website, and I really, really hope you'll all join this movement with me.
Yay. All right. I am at the front of the line. Jessica Zitter, thank you so much, folks. It's Dr. Holly Lucille, Mindful Medicine. We're just going to help you think things through here. We'll see you next time.